Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present journalist Tim Shorrock, who examines an agreement between the U.S. and North Korea to hold regional talks over Pyongyang's nuclear weapons program. Larry Burns of the Council on Hemispheric Affairs, who talks about Guatemala's highest court decision, granting former dictator Efraín Ríos Montt permission to run for the Guatemalan presidency November 9th. And Lisa Gyu, senior energy analyst with Public Citizen, who takes a critical look at recently passed congressional legislation that promotes expanded drilling for fossil fuels and the construction of new nuclear power plants. But first, we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
On July 16th, Human Rights Watch released a 17-page report titled Climate of Fear, Sexual Violence and Abduction of Women and Girls in Baghdad that points to a widespread problem of sexual violence that has been allowed to continue in Iraq. Hani Magali, executive director of the Middle East and North Africa divisions of Human Rights Watch, concluded that women and girls today in Baghdad are scared and many are not going to schools or jobs or looking for work. Through interviews with rape and abduction victims and witnesses, Human Rights Watch confirmed at least 25 credible rape allegations. They also found that Iraqi police were dismissing many of the charges where victims faced indifference and sexism from Iraqi law enforcement. The report includes documentation of a 9-year-old girl brutally raped by a man who grabbed her from a residence hotel. She was refused treatment at a hospital. In another case, a 23-year-old woman was grabbed while walking with family members, taken to a house outside Baghdad, and raped. Her father reported the case, but authorities never pursued the investigation. According to the report, U.S. military police have also been unwilling to conduct serious inquiries into rape and abduction allegations. Human Rights Watch has asked that the Iraqi and occupation forces undertake legal reforms and specifically that the U.S. establish a special investigative unit for sex crimes to protect Iraq's women and children. The oil giant Unocal will face a trial in Los Angeles for complicity in massive human rights abuses by the Myanmar military junta, including use of forced labor, rape, and torture. California Superior Court Judge Victoria Cheney rejected Unocal's claim that the suit by 14 villagers should be heard either in Myanmar or in Bermuda, where Unocal is registered as a public corporation. In her July 31st ruling, Judge Cheney stated, Unocal had specific knowledge that the use of forced labor was likely and nevertheless chose to proceed. According to the French press agency AFP, the case centers on the building of the controversial Yadana pipeline by Unocal and French oil giant Total, which will carry natural gas from fields in Myanmar to energy-hungry Thailand. A similar suit against Total has been filed in Europe. The Burmese villagers are suing for damages, contending that the oil company benefited from the Myanmar junta's practice of using forced labor in addition to rape and torture committed by Myanmar soldiers. The villagers in the complaint say they were forced to clear a route in the 1990s for the pipeline. For the moment, Unocal is considering an appeal. The trial is set to start in Los Angeles on September 22nd. Mother Jones magazine reports that presidential candidate Howard Dean has built his insurgent campaign around a powerful youth movement. Alabama native Gray Brooks, a student at a small Christian college, thought nothing of driving 1,200 miles to Burlington, Vermont for Dean's kickoff in June. The former Vermont governor has sprinted to the top of the pack of Democratic candidates with student volunteers like Brooks, who now works 7 days a week for Dean. Dean opened his campaign office 6 months ago with only $157,000 in campaign cash. Today, he's raised over $7 million and is a top contender in Iowa and New Hampshire against Dick Gephardt and John Kerry. By early July, students for Dean had 184 chapters working independently of the Dean campaign. The students are not just anti-war activists, but often political moderates worried about the budget deficit and government integrity. The surge of student energy for Dean has only won the disdain of the center-right Democratic Leadership Council, which has blasted Dean as far left for his strong opposition to the invasion of Iraq and support of civil unions for same-sex couples. This week's news summary was compiled by Britta Brundage and Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Sasha Summer-Cousineau.
North Korea and Washington announced August 1st that after a 10-month deadlock, the two nations have agreed to conduct regional talks on Pyongyang's nuclear weapons program, which will include representatives of South Korea, Russia, China, and Japan. North Korea's government says it dropped its previous insistence on bilateral negotiations with the U.S. because the direct talks it sought will be an integral part of the group discussions expected to begin in Beijing in early September. George W. Bush came into office openly hostile to a 1994 agreement between the U.S. and North Korea, which provided Western energy assistance to the impoverished nation in exchange for a pledge from leader Kim Jong-il to freeze his government's effort to develop nuclear weapons. North Korea admitted to maintaining a covert nuclear program last year only after U.S. officials confronted them with evidence that they were in violation of the agreement. But Pyongyang placed the blame on the U.S., which has labeled North Korea as part of an axis of evil for taking steps which forced them to nullify the accord. Critics of the Bush administration have noted the very different approaches taken in dealing with North Korea and Iraq. A war was launched against Baghdad on the allegation that the nation possessed weapons of mass destruction, which thus far cannot be found. Whereas the path toward negotiations remain open with Pyongyang, a nation that openly states it has several nuclear weapons and the capacity to build more. Between the lines, Scott Harris spoke with journalist Tim Shorrock, who has reported widely on Asian affairs. He examines the prospects that the upcoming talks could succeed in defusing a crisis which threatens to ignite conflict on the Korean Peninsula and a new regional nuclear arms race.
I think the Chinese have been playing a rather important intermediary role between the U.S. and North Korea. The Chinese have their own concerns about nuclear proliferation in that part of the world. They are justifiably concerned about the rise of militarism in Japan and statements by politicians and others there that, Japan should have its own nuclear capability, and they certainly don't want to see that. And so there's fears of an arms race in East Asia if North Korea begins mass production of nuclear weapons. And so they've been talking to the North Koreans about that. They're also worried about mass immigration or, mass exodus of people, refugees across the border could affect their economy and just society in general. There's already been hundreds of thousands of North Koreans, gone to China. Many have been sent back. So they have their concerns. But the Russians also, have been more assertive in diplomacy, and they've had a historically long relationship with North Korea when it was the USSR, and this particular announcement was actually made following the discussions between North Korean leaders and the Russian government. They clearly wanted the Russians in there. I think there is some possibility of some kind of agreement, but I think one of the big problems from our side is that the administration is deeply split. I mean, one day before these talks were announced, John Bolton, who's the Undersecretary of State, made this speech in Seoul, just, ripping into North Korea, calling it a hellish nightmare and just, blasting North Korea. It's not exactly the kind of statements you make before entering negotiations. And the North Koreans shot back saying, we don't want this human scum taking part in the talks. And they said, if he appears there, they won't talk. So, he represents this kind of real hard line of the Bush administration, people who don't believe in negotiating with North Korea at all. James Woolsey, in an editorial in the Wall Street Journal, one of the neocons who led us into the war with Iraq, was outlining, how you could make a successful military strike in North Korea, which is, to me, completely insane because, hundreds of thousands of people would die in a war there. But there's still some people here, willing to contemplate that. And so I think the fact that these negotiations are taking place is a good sign in itself.
Given that North Korea is in desperate straits with rampant starvation and the very survival of Kim Jong-il's regime, as well as the Bush administration's mistrust of that regime, what are the chances that conflict can be avoided and this thing will be negotiated, will be settled peacefully?
Both sides are going to have to, make some concessions. In July, there was a delegation from the U.S. Congress went, led by Kurt Weldon, a Republican from Pennsylvania. And they met with senior leadership in North Korea. And Weldon came back and made this proposal, which, seems to a lot of people here, very workable. Weldon said, let's have a one-year you know, kind of period of non-aggression. You know, we will not attack you, either side. And then North Korea agreed to freeze what it's doing now and open to inspections. And then the U.S. agreed in return for that to allow some economic aid and lift bans on, say, World Bank loans and that kind of thing. And sort of a framework like that, you know, perhaps in those multilateral talks, you know, the Chinese and the Russians can also have a role in assuring North Korea that they would not be, you know, the victims of an attack from the U.S. and that they will play a role in any economic reconstruction.
If we see successful negotiations where the United States promises non-aggression against North Korea, and it's seen by the world that the nuclear weapons North Korea produced were a key bargaining chip in getting protection from a U.S. attack, will that not feed into a sense of other developing nations that nuclear weaponry is the key to both the survival of their various regimes and also extracting concessions from the United States and other major powers around the world?
Yeah, ironically, I think that's what may happen. I mean, I think it's very clear that the North Koreans, you know, watched what happened in Iraq, and you know, Iraq just, you know, was dismantling a lot of its weapons of mass destruction and clearly did not have nuclear weapons. They've said, you know, they will use them to defend their country. They see it as the same right as any other nuclear weapons power. And so, yes, I think that, you know, a country like Iran, you know, they were labeled as part of the axis of evil, too. If they think, if it comes down to that, you know, to protect themselves, if to stop a U.S. attack, you know, have nuclear weapons, well, if it worked with North Korea, maybe it'll work with them. You know, this has been stated by a lot of people that, you know, want to stop nuclear proliferation. They think the Bush policy has, ironically or inadvertently, you know, helped proliferate nuclear weapons. But, I think mostly it is for their self-protection. You know, the rhetoric they hear from President Bush on down has certainly, you know, given them good reason to think that they might be the victim of an attack. And after all, they've had nuclear weapons aimed at them for 50 years, and the U.S. has nuclear-armed ships all around the Korean Peninsula. It's still a war that could easily turn nuclear. I think it's a dangerous situation, and I just can only, you know, hope that there's enough public pressure, you know, here and in South Korea, to keep our leaders on track and get negotiations going.
That was journalist Tim Shorrock. Read his January 27th Nation Magazine article titled "A Dangerous Game in Korea" online at www.thenation.com. On Tuesday, July 14th, former General Efrain Rios Montt, considered to be one of the most brutal dictators in Guatemalan history, was granted long-awaited permission to run for the Guatemalan presidency in a 4-3 vote by the nation's highest court. Rios Montt came to power through a coup d'etat in March of 1982 and was deposed by a counter-coup 18 months later. He has been accused by human rights groups and United Nations agencies of waging genocide against tens of thousands of Mayan civilians. Nearly half of the 700 massacres that took place in the 36 years of civil war in Guatemala occurred under Rios Montt, Brigadier General and pastor of the Evangelical Church of the Word, and his predecessor, Lucas Garcia. Critics charge that Rios Montt, educated in counterinsurgency tactics at the U.S.-funded School of the Americas, ordered the destruction of some 440 Mayan villages as part of a scorched-earth campaign to combat leftist insurgency with rifles and beans, a combination of military force and economic reforms. According to the Center for Human Rights Law Action, an estimated 60,000 individuals reportedly disappeared or died during this campaign, while untold numbers were subjected to torture. Since then, Montt has tried to run for the Guatemalan presidency twice, despite a 1985 constitutional provision barring former dictators from doing so. Larry Burns is the director of the Council on Hemispheric Affairs, or COHA. He spoke with your reporter, Denise Manzari, about Rios Montt's murderous reign and his manipulation of Guatemala's judicial system in securing the court decision to run for the presidency.
He forced these people into these relocation camps, these concentration camps. The sole purpose was that he assumed that the Indians were, the Mayans were sympathetic to the Guatemalan leftist guerrillas that were operating at that time. And at that period, which was during the Reagan era, there was absolutely no protest by Vice President Bush or by President Reagan over the policies of Rios-Montt. In fact, Guatemala was held in high esteem by the Reagan-Bush administrations for acting very brusquely in terms of treating this alleged communist threat to Guatemala. Now, when you say that the nation's highest court has reversed previous court rulings that found the Constitution would not allow anyone who had participated in the extra-constitutional overthrow of a government to be a presidential candidate, it's important to mention that the only way that Rios-Montt got the court to do this was to stack the court. That is, the FRG, which is the ruling party, the party of both Rios-Montt and the figurehead president of the country, President Portillo, that the legislative body appointed or elected several new judges, expanded the size of the court in order to deliver a favorable verdict in behalf of Rios-Montt's ability to run again. He still might not win, because there's an enormous feeling of outrage against this man, who is an extremely corrupt figure, very cynical figure, and totally irrelevant. That is, he's a person, he's a dinosaur from a past age. And it's rather interesting that even the this Bush administration, Ambassador Hamilton, issued a statement basically saying that the United States would find it very difficult to relate to a Rios-Montt government. Rios-Montt right now is president of the legislative body of Guatemala. He also is the president of the FRG, the ruling political party. And just a few days ago, his side called Guatemalans from the countryside to come into the capital city of Guatemala City and demonstrate against the subsequent decision by a Guatemalan court, which invalidated the ruling of the Constitutional Court and at least temporarily stayed the right of Rios-Montt to run for the presidency. Well, there was so much outrage on the part of Rios-Montt and his senior advisors that the army disappeared, the police were inactive, and there's an enormous amount of property damage done, as well as people surrounded the Supreme Court to deliver to those justices the message that it's dangerous to come to an independent decision. So the situation in Guatemala is deteriorating very rapidly. And remember that during the 1980s, year after year, Guatemala was the worst human rights violator, not only in Central America, but in all of Latin America.
Are people comfortable taking to the streets, let's say, in protest of Rios-Montt's possible election? Are they safe doing that?
While a number of the poor people somehow are mesmerized by Rios-Montt's projection of power and authority, a very large number of people despise him for being an appalling figure. I think that we are witnessing some wonderful counter trends taking place, which are, some of which are alarming, some of which are actually encouraging in Latin America. And with the election of people like Lula in Brazil and Chavez in Venezuela, a lot of the Latin American countries are not going to play the deferential role to Washington, which was their tradition. At the same time, we are seeing movements in the other direction taking place. I think that that's the case not only in Guatemala, but in El Salvador also, and we see in Nicaragua. The administration is not paying much attention to Latin America, and whether it's malign or benign neglect, it's neglect. And we see that relations between the North and the South have never been more complex or more troubling than they seem to be right now.
That was Larry Burns, Director of the Council on Hemispheric Affairs. For more information, contact COHA at 202-216-9261 or visit their website at www.coha.org. One of the Bush administration's first acts upon taking office in January 2001 was to convene an energy task force headed by Vice President Dick Cheney. The task force recommendations are still shrouded in secrecy and the subject of litigation to determine what role various energy companies played in its formulation. But one thing is clear. The administration's energy agenda is heavily weighted toward increasing production, especially of fossil fuels and nuclear power. Last year, bills were introduced in both the House and Senate that mirrored the Bush-Cheney energy plan. They promoted an expansion of drilling for oil and gas and the construction of a new generation of nuclear power plants with little support for renewable, non-polluting energy sources. However, the legislation failed to come out of conference committee before the 2002 elections. But with the Senate and House control now in Republican hands, energy bills similar to those stalled the previous year were recently passed again by Congress before it adjourned for its August recess. The bills will go to a conference committee in September, chaired by Republican Senator Peter Domenici, to work out the differences and be brought back for a final vote. Between the lines, Melinda Tuhu spoke with Lisa Gyu, senior energy analyst with Public Citizen, who says the legislation, if enacted, will be disastrous for the environment and for consumers. She discusses some of the specific items in the two bills and what it will take to stop the legislation from becoming law.
One of the issues that's particularly near and dear to the heart of Senator Domenici is boosting nuclear power. And nuclear power over the last few decades has proven itself really not to be viable either ecologically or economically. The bill that eventually passed the Senate is heavily pro-nuclear. It authorizes a program at the Department of Energy called Nuclear Power 2010, and that's basically the administration's program for bringing online a new generation of nuclear reactors by 2010, partly financed by taxpayers. So this new bill specifically directs the Secretary of Energy to, and I'm quoting here, aggressively pursue those activities that will result in regulatory approvals and design completion and the startup of new nuclear plants in the United States by 2010. And as part of that, the bill also directs the Secretary of Energy to investigate various government industry cost-sharing options to essentially subsidize this proposed new round of nuclear power plants. Another controversial provision in this Senate-passed bill is reauthorization of the Price-Anderson Act, and that is a little-known subsidy, again, to nuclear power operators that limits their liability in the event of a nuclear accident. So it's basically a big insurance subsidy to the nuclear industry because it lowers the amount of insurance that these owners have to carry. The House-passed bill also reauthorizes the Price-Anderson Act, but it includes some moderate nuclear security provisions to go along with it, basically saying very reasonably that if taxpayers are going to be shouldering the burden for potential accidents or attacks at nuclear power plants, we better make sure that everything is being done to reduce the likelihood of that kind of event. Another issue that is found in slightly different forms in both the House and Senate bills has to do with nuclear waste reprocessing. Well, for the last three decades, the U.S. has sensibly banned commercial reprocessing of nuclear waste because of these proliferation concerns. But now, in a distasteful reversal of U.S. non-proliferation policy, the Bush administration and both of these energy bills would throw money at attempting to restart commercial reprocessing of nuclear waste. And that's basically any technology that takes this irradiated nuclear fuel and is capable of separating out weapons-usable plutonium from it, which is then much more vulnerable to theft and diversion by terrorists, for example. And also promotes the spread of a technology that is really undesirable around the world, as North Korea is demonstrating right now.
What about issues related to fossil fuels like coal, oil, and natural gas?
Both bills contain tax incentives and subsidies for your traditional fossil fuel industries. Notably, the House bill includes a provision that opens up the Arctic Wildlife Refuge for oil drilling, and that's not part of the Senate-passed bill. So that's going to be another controversial issue as these two versions of the bill are reconciled. In terms of a transition towards renewable energies, the Senate-passed bill contains a very, very watered-down renewable portfolio standard requirement. The House bill actually doesn't include any renewable standard at all, so that is going to be probably one of the other contentious issues in the conferencing process. And finally, I'd point to sort of a bigger issue in electricity overall, and that has to do with the rush to deregulate the electricity market. But illogically, both the House and the Senate bill would repeal the most important consumer protection law relating to regulation of the electricity markets. It's called PUCA, the Public Utility Holding Company Act. Both bills are inadequate when it comes to protecting consumers from market instability and rate increases.
Assuming these bills are reconciled in conference committee, is there anything that can be done to stop this legislation?
Then there is the opportunity for lawmakers to filibuster, for example, a conference report and prevent this legislation from becoming law. If Senator Domenici and his cohorts live up to the promises that they've made this week and last about rewriting the bill in conference, that's what's going to be necessary. And we hope we see the leadership in the Senate to take the action necessary to prevent this legislation from becoming law. It's certainly an uphill battle, and it's a disappointing turn of events. But, I mean, on the other hand, last year's bill got to exactly this spot and then failed to even be reported out of a conference committee.
That was Lisa Gu of Public Citizen. For more information, call area code 202-454-5130 or visit their website at www.citizen.org. To find out how legislators voted and to send a free fax opposing the bills to your representatives, visit www.stopenergybill.org. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced at the studios of WPKN Radio and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, or would like a recording of today's program, please contact Between the Lines by calling area code 203-331-9756 or write to Between the Lines, care of WPKN Radio, 244 University Avenue, Bridgeport, Connecticut, 06604. You can also visit our website at www.btlonline.org. Our theme music was written and performed by Mika Top. This week's program was produced by Scott Harris with the assistance of Britta Brundage, Sasha Summer-Cousineau, Bill Cosentino, Anna Manzo, Harry Minot, Bob Nixon, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Denise Manzari.